Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello, and welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott. Dr. George Valiant is a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and the Department of Psychiatry at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Dr. Valiant has spent his research career charting adult development and the recovery process of schizophrenia, heroin addiction, alcoholism, and personality disorder. He spent the last 35 years as director of the study of adult development at the Harvard University Health Center. The study has prospectively charted the lives of 824 men and women for almost 70 years. His published works include Adaptation to Life, 1977, The Wisdom of the Ego, 1993, The Natural History of Alcoholism, Revisited, 1995, and Aging Well, 2002. His most recent book on positive emotions, Spiritual Evolution, was published by Doubleday Broadway in 2008. Dr. Valiant has received the Foundation's Funder Prize for Research in Psychiatry from the American Psychiatric Association, the Strecker Award from the Institute of Pennsylvania Hospital, and the Jelinek Award for Research in Alcoholism. Most recently, he received the Distinguished Service Award from the American Psychiatric Association. Welcome, Dr. Valiant.
Welcome.
I just put a bit of personal history in. It turns out that I knew Dr. Valiant and his wife in the 80s in Boston, when I think we were all working on nuclear disarmament and the nuclear weapons freeze. Is that right, George?
A picture of the celebration of life, Mother's Day, May 1982, is staring at me from the wall.
Oh, really? Am I holding up a baby?
No, I wish you were. It's just two women holding up doves, but you certainly... I remember the picture.
Yeah, that's lovely. Well, I got on to, I'll call you George, okay? I got on to George again by reading a fascinating article in The Atlantic, June 2009, called What Makes Us Happy? And it is, in fact, about a study of male Harvard graduates starting in 1940, 41, 42, and there were over 200 in the study, and it's called the Grant Study, named after the person who granted the money to do the study. And would you like to talk about how you got involved in this study, George? And I found it most fascinating about what happened to these characters through their lives and whether or not you can predict happiness from their childhood, from their college years and the like. So How did you get involved in this?
Well, I had been very interested in recovery from incurable illnesses. So I'd done a study of recovery from schizophrenia, and then I did a study of recovery from heroin addiction. Mm-hmm. And I went to the health services and said, look, they're going to be the 25th reunion, and I'd be interested if there were people who'd had schizophrenic breaks during their year in college and then interviewing them 25 years later. And they said that actually there wasn't any health service. And all they could offer me was a group of men studied because they were healthy. And at first I thought, goodness, how terribly dull.
Yeah.
And then I knew enough about how you recovered, the process of resilience in schizophrenia and in heroin addiction. And I thought, well, you know, it, we all have troubles, and why not study in healthy men the same coping mechanisms that seem to be important in schizophrenia and heroin addiction? And so that was how I got involved with the study. And as soon as I started reading the lives, these men had been studied continuously for 25 years, but to justify funding, a couple of books had been published after they'd been studied for 5 years, and absolutely the dullest things you ever read. I mean, 25-year-old men are not the world's most exciting people.
Unless you're a woman, George.
I speak from experience. Helen, I wasn't, but I agree with you that
I speak from experience.
That does put a different light on it.
Yeah.
Good on you. Anyway, by the time they were at their 25th reunion, they were absolutely fascinating. They'd had all sorts of adventures, and some people who were no-hopers had turned out fine, and some people who were destined for stardom were doing very badly indeed, so that it was suddenly became very much more interesting. But just as with the recovered schizophrenics and heroin addicts, what was exciting was the men who had had difficulties and had overcome them.
Yes, well, it turns out some of them became quite famous. Four members ran for the U.S. Senate. One served in a presidential cabinet, and one became president, who was Kennedy, and I believe his files are locked up for until 2040. Norman Mailer was one of them, but in fact, most of them remain.
No, he wasn't.
Oh, he wasn't. I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. The two really interesting men, Norman Mailer and Leonard Bernstein, I think seemed much too eccentric to the nice, respectable WASP doctors that were doing the study.
Oh, how fascinating. So they left them out.
Oh, they weren't studying fascinating, Helen. They were trying to study normal, by which they meant people that you'd be delighted to invite into your white shoe law firm.
But no eccentrics at that time, right? Which is, I always think, the spice of society, eccentricity. So what did you do, George? How did you follow these people? And just give us a little broad picture with a broad brush about some of the more interesting ones and how you found them fascinating.
Sure. The method of study is a little bit like looking at people through the wrong end of the telescope. Instead of a magnifying glass, which are what doctors and psychoanalysts usually do, this was looking at them from afar. So I interviewed them at their 25th reunion, and then almost 20 years later, interviewed them as they were retiring.
So 25th reunion, they would have been 45.
They were 45, and then I interviewed them again at 65 or whenever they retired.
Yeah.
And there was one man who had been badly severe PTSD after fighting in the Battle of the Bulge. And he
PTSD, you should spell that out.
A post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes.
In the Battle of the Bulge, and had retired first to the wilderness of Montana and then decided that was too close for comfort, and he emigrated to New Zealand. And it was time for his retirement, so I tried to reach him in New Zealand, and the telephone operator said his number had been changed, and so the telephone operator bicycled out to the school where he was living, got his number, sort of patched me through first to the headmaster in the middle of the night, and then I went out to New Zealand to find that he'd gone to a school play and had left a bottle of whiskey on the table, which when he returned from the play, we both helped finish. So that was just one adventure, but a sense of the tracking everyone down. Nobody in the study has been lost. A few in college withdrew, but in general, people have been terribly loyal and have very much hung in there.
Well, they considered it a privilege to be part of the Harvard study, did they not?
Well, they did, actually. It was kind of funny because I was 33 and wet behind the ears, and these some of them were pretty socially proper and some of them were professionally fairly far up the tree, and they always treated me a little bit like I was the boarding school doctor.
Yes.
Rather than I was just a young sprat trying to track them down.
One of the cases I found most fascinating, which is described in this Atlantic article, was the one you called, Alan Poe?
Yeah.
I found that absolutely fascinating. Would you like to describe, because he's anonymous, what his background was and
sure.
And how he appeared initially in the study?
He was, the absolute out of central casting of the model of the conscientious objector, the person who the rest of the world saw as bohemian and eccentric, and who, in fact, understood the world much better than the people who criticized him. During World War II, where conscientious objectors were relatively few, he worked in dangerous medical jobs. He then got married twice and realized that wasn't what he wanted and sort of struggled rather like E.M. Forster did with writing, that the best writing he did was before he came out, where he was intensely unhappy, but writing rather brilliantly. And then inspired by the Stonewall Rebellion in Greenwich Village, which to people who don't know the struggle for gay rights, it was a critical moment in allowing people to publicly announce that they were gay.
And, mm-hmm. That was 1947, wasn't it, in New York?
1971.
Oh, no, sorry, 1971 in New York.
No, Ellen.
Right.
It took Americans rather a long time to... that. In the study, there was one man who didn't announce he was gay until, didn't even discover himself he was gay until he was 76.
Oh, my God. So what happened to this man, Poe?
Well, I'm struggling because it's both a story of triumph and of tragedy that he saw the world as it was, so that it was perfectly clear to him that Ho Chi Minh admired Thomas Jefferson much more than he admired Joseph Stalin, and the United States government, in their stupidity, saw North Vietnam as the enemy rather than even more easily turn to an ally than Yugoslavia was. And he sort of carried this lucidity, whether it was the folly of war or the empathizing with other people. And he also understood that to be the successful bond broker, that the Grant Study a little bit wanted people not to make waves and be respectable. And he had sort of spent his life in a constructive and caring way, being the healing uncle to lots of the young men in the San Francisco beach area where he lived, and being really quite caring. Mm. But the difficulty is he had developed alcoholism, which, because he was rebellious, he saw as an asset more than a curse. And like many hard-drinking creative artists, for a while he could live in both worlds. And when I ended my interview with him in middle life, I had compared him to the Stockton short story of the young gladiator whose jilted lover had offered him the choice of two doors, and behind one was the beautiful slave girl, and behind the other was a lion. And in the story, you didn't know, she had told him to open the left door. And in the story, you didn't know which was going to be behind the door. And tragically, the door turned out to be the lion. And just as he was beginning to get control of his alcoholism, he fell down stairs intoxicated and died.
Oh, dear.
So that it's, but he, I had been to San Francisco to go to the opera and went to interview him in his bohemian flat in my going to the opera pinstriped suit. And he had a little bit of fun with me.
Teasing you.
But he was. He was spot on the entire time, which was what delighted me, that he was irreverent, but on the side of the angel.
Well, you know, that's interesting because as a physician, I've seen some schizophrenic patients, not many, because I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm a pediatrician, but it's always been my assessment, I guess, that sometimes schizophrenics or people who are classified as mentally ill have much more clarity in understanding the world and various dynamics than do, quotes, normal people who are using their defense mechanisms to appear respectable and okay. Would you agree with that, George?
Well, I think it's pushing it somewhat with schizophrenics, but I think the terrible thing about the modern world, and one can sort of blame Gutenberg for it, is that we live more and more in our left and rational brains, and we forget to use our heart. And I think whenever you see someone who is unconventional and is preferred to live in the world of emotion and right brain, that they are often much closer to the truth, that so much of what's important can only be understood through metaphor, and to see it all as bean counting and looking at the world too literally, one gets in great trouble. And my most recent book, Spiritual Evolution, is contrasting the logic of people like Richard Dawkins, who can quite rightly say that miracles don't happen, and there's probably nobody up there with a gray beard called God, and say, ha, we've shown you, and forgetting that in order to speak with our hearts, we need to use poetry and not logic, and there's really no point to living if you don't pay more attention to your heart than otherwise.
Yeah.
And you'll be perhaps interested to know that Caroline, who tried to work with you some on getting women in the United States and Russia to talk to each other as an effort to nuclear disarmament, also worked very hard on this study with me and was the person who was best at finding men who were lost and figuring out how to track them down.
That's fascinating. Caroline is George Valiant's wife, and she's Australian, and I did work with her in the 80s. It was my notion, and that this follows on to what you've just said, George, and I should say that Dr. Valiant is a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and the Department of Psychiatry at Brigham and Women's Hospital. It was my notion during the 80s when I was bashing around the country talking about nuclear war and how imminent it seemed, that very often after I gave a talk, people would come down and surround me. In fact, they still do. A majority would be women, and there'd be a man standing and say, "You weren't right. It's 356 cruise missiles, not 352. And the women around would scream at him and say, "That's exactly the kind of thinking that's going to kill us all."
Well, my favorite is the fox in The Little Prince, who wrote, "Only the heart sees what is essential. What's important is invisible to the eye." And
yeah,
it's unfair to human beings to say that it's simply a female trait, but it certainly is escaping from the dominance of what is written down. I mean, words are really terribly misleading, which is why people get so upset about other people's credos. And yet, if you just go into any place of worship and listen to the music and pay attention to the sense of awe in anyone from the caveman's Lascaux or Altamira to Notre Dame or great mosques, you've got no trouble with the fact that positive emotion, which is clearly peace and not war, is everywhere in no one's particular province.
Yeah, well, and to the subject of women and men, I believe, and I want to write about this in my next book, the corpus callosum, the connection between the right and left brain, is larger in women than men.
Yes.
And that's absolutely fascinating, because it really is true that most women are much more in touch with their emotions than men, and that's why the men drive them crazy sometimes, because you can't communicate with them, you know, at a level that, as you have just pointed out, is so almost important.
But part of it is simply not paying attention, that I've been fascinated at the degree to which both psychology and psychiatry are afraid of positive emotions. And if you talk about joy and hope and love, people screw up their faces.
Oh, really?
And if instead you talk about terrorism and anger and depression, everyone's very happy and think that you're a pretty sophisticated person.
But why is that, George, amongst the psychiatric and psychological profession?
Well, I think it's the same reason that 8-year-old boys are afraid of girls who might want to kiss them. That positive emotions make us feel vulnerable. That,
yeah,
by definition, when you're cuddling, when you're feeling joyful,
yeah,
when you're feeling grateful, you have your guard down.
Yeah.
And I mean, after all, as the pediatrician, you know that the most vulnerable thing that can happen to anyone is that they have a child. After that, you stop being interested in nuclear bombs and think maybe it would be a good idea if we had peace.
That's right.
And how vulnerable does that make you? I mean, the Ruskies are going to come and get you if you start worrying about your school children surviving rather than turning them into cannon fodder.
Yeah, but why would the psychiatric and the psychological profession be scared of vulnerability? I mean, that seems to be the antithesis of what they should be up to. I don't get it. Are they defending their vulnerability? I mean, where are they at?
No, I mean, Helen, I think, to be fair, they're just like people.
They're just like people.
And that people are too governed by left brain and reason. I mean, it isn't, I pick on psychologists and psychiatrists because that's me and my kin, but I think if you're trying to understand the world in general, why does Fox News, which only points out the unpleasant, be so much more successful than someone like Helen Caldicott, who's trying to raise issues like conservation and looking after the planet? I mean, then a flower garden is a whole lot more fun than an industrial chemical plant. And yet the train accidents are news. And people's flower gardens aren't. It's put it in simpler terms. Positive emotions mean that you've let down your guard and you're open to the world. And that's the only way you can possibly find happiness or make friends.
Yeah.
So it's essential to, from procreation on, and yet you certainly are vulnerable in those conditions to the things that go bump in the night. So it's much easier for people hollering danger and hate your neighbors to get people's attention and even their allegiance.
Yeah. I was fascinated by Alan Poe, who pointed out that the sort of men the Grant study prized fought on the side of the Nazis, whereas the cooks and the homosexuals were all in the resistance. I was fascinated by that. So, you know, if you think convention was like the Germans at the Nuremberg trials when they asked why they were, you know, intent on killing all the Jews, they were found actually to be clinically sane by psychiatric assessment. And they said, well, we're just following the law. We were just following the law. And there's a huge disconnect. And the Nuremberg principles enunciated that every person is morally responsible for what his or her society does. And I don't think that's very obvious in today's world. Do you?
I think it's terribly, important to raise people's consciousness. And the best way I can deal with it is to use the analogy of Ralph Nader, who points out that cars are unsafe at any speed, and yet most people in the world find their automobiles rather comforting if you're not trying to practice saving the environment, but you're just letting me use this as a metaphor. And where it becomes important to what you're talking about is that religion is terribly dangerous in that it kills probably 100,000 people a year for no very good reason. And yet you have 5 billion people who, because of the emphasis of spirituality on right brain and the heart, are reminded that, yes, it is important to be courageous and to stand up for what's right, even though that's not necessarily popular or the law. And so that, the whole underpinnings of Christianity, if you can avoid its use in politics or taking what the Bible says too literally, is in praising someone who challenged the law and turned over the tables of the money changers.
I mean, absolutely.
I mean, certainly Christ and equally dramatically Mandela were first-class troublemakers, and yet in retrospect, we admire them enormously, and it's finding some way of drawing the morally courageous to people's attention. But I think it's very important not to be prejudiced, and I don't think that gays or blacks or women are any nobler than respectable straight males, and it's whether they pay attention to their hearts or their intellects. And I mean, Nazism in part was built on American and English eugenics, and it was terribly reasonable. I mean, any good pediatrician could understand that you only let children with good genes pass them on, and that's a terribly good thing for pediatrics, only it doesn't work. I mean, it just makes people mean-spirited and ignore what's human, but it's always tempting to be rational and think that's going to be a good thing.
Yeah, or to suppress the feelings. You know, we're doing this interview. This is Dr. George Valiant, incidentally, who's a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. We're doing this interview, George, just after Robert McNamara died, who I got to know quite well in his later years.
Really? And
it was interesting because I held a conference called 3 Minutes to Midnight in Washington for 2 days on the impending threat of nuclear war at this very time. It was a couple of years ago. And I had the very best brains, both pro-nuclear war, if you will, and anti-nuclear war for 2 days. And it was a very respectful discussion. But I rang Bob McNamara and I said, I want you to open it. He didn't know who I was. Well, I suppose he did, but I didn't know him. He said, oh, no. He said, I'm too old. I don't know enough. And I said, oh, well, I think that's wrong, Bob. But anyway, he said no. So I got to the conference. It was a day of a blizzard too, but a lot of people came. Sitting in the very front row was Bob McNamara. And blimey, he totally dominated the conference. He stood up and asked the most provocative questions right from the beginning. And everyone was...
And he was on your side.
Oh, totally. And at the end, I closed...
Well, now, who would have guessed when he was a young man making huge amounts of money in the auto business and turning, I guess it was Ford around, who would have thought that a bean counter would have come over and worked at the right hand of Helen Caldicott?
Well, you know, I gave the final speech at the conference and he came up and he said, you are greatly underestimated in this town. And it was in Washington, D.C. And he then became quite a supporter of mine. We actually wrote an article for the L.A. Times describing the fact that there are, at this moment, 60 hydrogen bombs targeted on New York City alone, whereas Bush et al. Were rushing around talking about terrorists, you know, knocking down the World Trade Towers, which was a dreadful thing. But compared to 60 H-bombs arriving in the middle of the night on New York City or Washington or many other cities.
Oh, Helen, 3,000 lives compared to what even a little war can produce is minuscule.
I know.
I mean, compare the number of Palestinians who've lost their lives compared to the 3,000 in the World Trade Center. I mean, it was a terrible thing, but it's a tragedy of 3,000 lives. It's not a tragedy of...
Of the whole of the United States of America. Well, you know, if there is a nuclear war, as he and I, McNamara and I pointed out, you know, it'll probably mean the end of most human beings on the planet. And those bombs are ready to go right now with the press of the button, and the whole thing would be over in about an hour. And he was very deeply affected by the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was in the Oval Office as those decisions were being made. And I think it was he who suggested quietly to Kennedy that the American missiles in Turkey, which were a thorn in the Russian side, be removed in order for Khrushchev to remove their missiles from Cuba. And that's actually what worked and saved the world. But he said to me quietly, we were having lunch in the Cosmos Club in Washington, he said, "Helen, you don't know how close we came." He said it was within minutes.
Mm.
And I think that influenced the rest of his life. He was a deeply troubled man. He said to me once, I think that I didn't do the right thing. A lot of people think I didn't do the right thing in Vietnam. And I said, no, you didn't, Bob. So,
forgive me.
What are you laughing at?
Well, I'm laughing at your simple candor. I mean, I totally agree with you, Alan, but you just put it so nicely.
Well, anyway, so he's a fascinating man to study, and the obituaries are pages long in the New York Times and the Washington Post. He'll be remembered as a sort of iconic figure in a certain sense.
Well, now, forgive me, because the only death that I've heard on the news programs I listen to are Michael Jackson. When did McNamara die?
2 days ago.
Really?
Well, yeah, but you must be reading the New York Times or the Washington Post, George, to it was announced yesterday. He died at 93 in his sleep. Have you been just watching television?
I see. All right. No, I have not seen any news in the last 20. You'll be interested to know that we had Barry Brazelton to dinner.
Ah.
Speaking of pediatricians.
Oh, it was Barry.
Last night.
Oh.
And so we had dinner with him instead of turning on the news.
Right. Did you tell him that I was going to interview you that night?
No, actually, he's slowed down a lot.
Oh.
So that I think we talked mainly about his children and our
children.
Yeah. And something as complicated as Helen Caldicott, I think, wasn't where his head was at. But
well, I think that Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament actually gave Barry Brazelton the Helen Caldicott Peace Award. He, for those who don't know who he is, he's a very, very famous pediatrician who did some really outstanding studies in childhood development and is absolutely honoured throughout the world, I think, for his work in pediatrics. But I'd like to move on now, George, to your recent book, Spiritual Evolution, and the conclusions you've come to that will produce happiness and how we can achieve these emotions, joy, compassion, forgiveness, trust or faith, hope, awe or love, and the neglect in the modern world of these positive emotions. And I think particularly in the United States, positive emotions are confused with pleasure and happiness and money and hedonism and not relationships or emotional intelligence. And a successful old age is not dependent upon brains or ambition or social class or money. And I always say that, you know, when you talk to patients on their deathbed, they're not upset about the amount of money they have or haven't earned or the sort of jobs or success they've made of their work. But what is foremost in their mind is their relationships, past relationships, which either they rue or wish they'd been better at, or those who love become incredibly important to them. So I'm sorry, I've preempted you a little, George.
I just think you've read my book, Helen, that's all. I'm afraid we're on the same wavelength.
I mean, it's...
Even though I'm a quite straight male.
A quite straight male, but you're not really quite straight, are you, George? Nobody is.
I'm just teasing you.
I know you are, and I'm teasing you too. But, it always strikes me, I mean, when men's children were dying of cystic fibrosis, and my patients were ones with cystic fibrosis, and they all die early at some stage, that when they're in such grief and their hearts are opening up, they fall into my arms weeping and they admit to me all the really wicked things they've done in their lives. And they do that too on their deathbeds, their own deathbeds. But by then it's too late. But some men whose children have died actually have a profound conversion to, as you talk about, altruism and doing the right thing for the world. I was struck by one of the people in the Grant study who went through a terrible time, I think, and then suddenly got it and became altruistic and realized the only way to happiness is to serve other people in a certain sense. Would you like to talk about that, George, and some of the subjects I've just sort of covered?
Well, I would love to, Helen. There are two clear differences between what I'm calling the positive emotions and there's three differences between negative emotions like sadness, fear, anger. I mean sadness, pathological sadness. I don't mean grief.
Mm-hmm.
And the positive emotions like joy and appreciation and gratitude and love. And the first difference is that the negative emotions are all about me and the positive emotions are all pro-social.
Huh.
Gratitude, love, trust. There's always another person in the positive emotions.
Yeah.
The second is the negative emotions are all about now, which is what makes them so important to the newspapers. And the positive emotions are about the future. And the third is that if you give people intellectual tasks, whether making judgments that could be affected by prejudice or just simple tests of creativity like anagrams, that when you're experiencing negative emotions, you become more bigoted and less creative. And when you're experiencing induced positive emotions, you become more creative and less bigoted. In other words, more inclusive of other people so that the radius that you're, the number of people that you're willing to include as us and not them becomes broader. So that positive emotions, instead of being just making us vulnerable. From a biologic point of view, negative emotions arouse the sympathetic nervous system, which when I was in medical school always seemed the good side of the body, getting you ready for fight and flight and making you a splendid football player or a pursuit pilot. And the parasympathetic emotions were all about rest and digest and were only for wusses.
And parasympathetic nervous system induces sneezing, which is a kind of orgasm, and also induces sexual orgasm, parasympathetic system. So that's interesting, isn't it?
Well, it also produces tears. That the sympathetic nervous system blocks tears and the parasympathetic nervous system facilitates tears.
Oh, that's
and
fascinating.
Anybody that's a good poet knows that grief and joy are very closely tied. But it's when an animal is resting and digesting and cuddling a newborn baby, they're terribly vulnerable.
Yeah.
And it's have none of the sort of macho swagger that Mercutio and Romeo with their soon-to-be-fatal swords were swaggering about in the streets of Verona. And it's very hard to make that shift. And what's happened is only in the 21st century have the brain sciences and the sophistication of psychological experiments reach the point where you can show that even to the left brain, positive emotions are a lot more adaptive. I mean, to take the nukes out of Turkey was positively inspired, and all it was win-win. We didn't lose anything.
No. We run the world.
We gave nothing away.
We run the world.
Except save the world.
Yeah. Well, how can people who live in their negative emotions, and I guess we all know people like that, sadness and grief and I guess narcissists too, how can they move from that negative perspective? Can they do it consciously? How can they move from those emotions that fix them in the present? And they're very egocentric in a certain sense, to moving beyond that to the wider society.
Helen, I think you have to get their attention.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that you've tried terribly hard to do all your life, is to get people's attention.
Yeah.
And in a purely scientific way, what 21st century brain science has done is to show that in a fMRI machine, the same parts of the brain light up when you give money that you could keep. It's the experimenter's money, and the experimenter gives the subject money, and they either can keep it or they can give it to their favorite charity.
Yeah.
Now, they don't want to give it in taxes, or most of them don't, because they don't understand that, you know, things like health care for the uninsured is going to come out
sure.
of someone's taxes.
Sure.
But the act of giving to someone in need that you approve of produces exactly the same excitement in the reward areas of the brain that heroin does.
Heroin. Oh.
And if you think of what the opiate receptor, I mean, our ancestors didn't evolve by shooting dope. Our ancestors involved the opiate system to reinforce maternal care. And so that's the system of love is addicting for very good reasons of childcare. And if you find the actual chemical, you can short-circuit that just as you can short-circuit sex with masturbation, but it's a lot more fun to be cuddled by someone else than by a dirty magazine.
Yeah, well, I know that when I had my babies, I became so addicted to that love. I'd never felt that sort of love before. And every time I didn't feel happy in my marriage, I thought, I know, I'll have another baby. And so I had three in 3 years and probably would have gone on forever. I mean, you can understand the overpopulation problem and the drive that human beings have to reproduce because it's so incredibly joyful. So the point...
But there you see it. What you're talking about is joy and not happiness.
Yeah.
I feel happy when I get a dress on sale or win $50 in the lottery.
Yeah.
I feel joy if only I could be a woman and have a baby, but being a dad and having babies is about the most exciting thing I've ever done.
Oh, well, George, that's lovely. I think we've used up our time, unfortunately, because I think we could go on talking virtually forever. it's been absolutely fascinating, and please give my love to the lovely Caroline, and I hope to see you again soon in Boston.
Well, we have friends in Bermagui, so I hope our paths cross.
Thanks very much, George.
Okay, bye, Helen.
Bye. I've been interviewing Dr. George Valiant, who's a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. His most recent work has concentrated upon spiritual evolution, and he wrote about that in the book Spiritual Evolution, which was published by Doubleday Broadway in 2008. I think this has been an absolutely fascinating interview, relevant to every single one of us in the world today. And thank you for listening to If You Love This Planet. If you'd like to help us continue with this, I think, pretty wonderful program, you can go to our webpage, ifyoulovethisplanet.org, and there is a page there where you can donate money if you would like.
You're now about to hear a speech given by Dr. Helen Caldicott on April the 10th, 2009, in Brattleboro, Vermont, where a large section of the community are fighting against the Vermont Yankee nuclear reactor.
It seems appropriate. I'm here in Brattleboro, which is just next to Massachusetts, where I used to live for about 18 years. We've just been down to look at the plant. It is... It's like going to Savannah River. I feel like I'm descending into Hades. I couldn't believe how many farms there were around, and cows and silage and sheep and children, and God Almighty, there's a primary school right next to it. Paid for, I hear, by Entergy. That's absolutely wicked. And I am only here for one reason, in Brattleboro. That plant gets closed down next year, period. It gets closed down. Now, when I went to the State House yesterday, they're all talking about money. Decommissioning money and this money and that money. This has nothing to do with money. When you go to the doctor, well, your healthcare system's not very good, is it? They talk to you about money. Healthcare has nothing to do with money. Medicine has. When I first graduated and did my first locum, they paid me. I didn't ever realise I'd be paid for practising medicine. It was such a privilege to practise medicine on patients. I was embarrassed. Then I found out some of my colleagues had done medicine to get rich, and some of them did. But this is about health. This is about preventive medicine and public health. Period. Don't ever let anyone sidetrack you into money or legal systems, because they'll tie you up with court cases and stuff till the cows come home, and there are lots of cows here. Yeah. This is all about preventive medicine. Now, how do we teach people to stop smoking? We taught the kids in schools about smoking and cancer. Kids went home to their parents and said, "Mum, you've got to stop smoking." And now most people don't smoke, although the incidence of lung cancer in women now is higher than breast cancer. Because it takes up to 20 years to develop the lung cancer, and they're getting lung cancer. And that's it, curtains, once you get lung cancer. But smoking only kills the smoker. Well, some passive smoking might be dangerous for babies and the like. But this plant is going to kill hundreds of thousands of people or more over time for all future generations. This plant is a cancer factory. That's all it is. It's a cancer factory. Its byproduct is, you know, a little bit of electricity so you can turn your computers on and stuff. It boils water. It's what it was designed to do. All it does is boil water. My God, there are other ways to boil water rather than fissioning the atom. Yes. The uranium that's put in, now I can talk about a 1,000 megawatt reactor because that's what I've learnt. Yours is 650, but let's extrapolate. The uranium becomes 1 billion times more radioactive when it's put in that damn reactor. 1 billion times. There's as much radiation, long-lived radiation, in a 1,000 megawatt reactor as that produced by 1,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs. These are deadly, deadly instruments. And they were made initially in the Manhattan Project to make nuclear weapons. This is a bomb factory. It was designed initially, nuclear reactors, to make plutonium. That thing will, a 1,000 megawatt reactor makes 500 pounds of plutonium a year, and all you need is 10 pounds to make a bomb. Well, they're selling them all over the place. I mean, they're selling them to Saudi Arabia and Lebanon, and Libya will build one, and Iraq's building one, and, you know, well, it's a good thing to sell reactors, isn't it? We're selling bomb factories. Nuclear power is about two things. It's about cancer and it's about nuclear weapons, and its byproduct is electricity. And there's only 20 years' supply of high-grade uranium in the whole world. How do I know? I come from Australia. The Australian continent is so ancient, all the mountains have washed away. And you know, when we first went there, well, when we invaded and stole it from the Aboriginal people, you'd walk along creek beds and just kick gold nuggets. There are huge mountains of iron ore, tin, silver, copper, and we've got 40% of the world's richest uranium, and by God, is our government wanting to dig the blasted stuff up. They are immoral. Well, we're not having nuclear power in Australia because it's too dangerous for us. We're just selling uranium so everyone else can get the cancers. That is so immoral, it's beyond my imagination. And when people say I'm emotional, or when the nuclear industry says I don't know what I'm talking about, and I was on some radio program this morning, Mark someone, who was it?
Mark Johnson.
Yeah. This man rang in, he said, where did you get your medical degree? And where else did you get one? And I said, you know, I was at Harvard on the faculty. And he said, have you ever done engineering, a course in engineering? How dare you talk about nuclear power? You don't understand engineering. I've built 3 nuclear power plants. And I said, have you done any medicine? Do you know about biology? Well, he was very rude and he kept talking and interrupting. And I said, do not interrupt me. And finally, Mark cut him off. Very rude man. And then I got another rude man on the line. An engineer, you know. I think some men, none of the men in this room, but some men, their reptilian brain has a toxic reaction to testosterone and they use their left brain to rationalise what their reptilian brain wants them to do. Whereas women, and we're real wimps, we're 53% of the population, we allow these men, many of who have Asperger's syndrome, but they're very clever. They're very clever. We allow them to do their evil. And we're pathetic. And we're 53% of the population. So it's time we stepped up to the plate and we took over. I don't mean taking men out of the equation at all. I mean working with them. The two important hormones to which we react and affect our behaviour are one, testosterone, and we know what testosterone does, and the other one in women is not so much estrogen, progesterone, it's oxytocin. I don't know why you live here. I wouldn't live here for all the tea in China. I'm serious. I'm sure it's a great town. Vermont's a wonderful state. If that thing blows, probably the whole of Vermont will be uninhabitable forevermore. Evermore.
That was part of a speech delivered by Dr. Helen Caldicott on April the 10th, 2009, in Brattleboro, Vermont.
Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and edited by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.